Okay, I'd like to introduce our speaker getter, who will introduce our speaker. Rick.
Hey.
Hi, my name's Rick. So first of all, I want to thank our speaker because he did this on extremely short notice because the speaker that I was going to be speaking wasn't able to make it after all. It's Eric with a K. Eric, since I started here 4 years ago, I mean, every time I see him, you just want to smile or laugh. And we always do this wild guitar thing. I think the men on Thursday night know that. So I'm really looking forward to Eric with a K speaking.
Hi everybody, my name is Eric Forsberg and I'm a very grateful Alamo. Sometimes referred to as Eric with a K or Eric with a car, like tonight. People like to, you know, just throw acronyms after my name. Some of the other ones that I've been given was a special K. I kind of thought that was nice, you know. Wish my ex-wife just called me that every once in a while. Kidding. Another one was, from the offside when I busted my Achilles, had a cane. I was walking around with a cane, a walking cane, and somebody decided to call me Eric with a cane. And I proceeded to be cured of that illness almost overnight, and the next day they just simply called me Eric without a cane. So it kind of stuck, you know. Anyway, you know, we're all here tonight, and, you know, because in some way or another, someone's problem with alcoholism has touched our lives. And that's certainly true for me. But I spent most of my life not realizing that. I just sort of figured that was normal. Alcoholism in my family sort of started to gallop right past the drinking phases, right into the family orientation part of it, where it's all more or less behavioral stuff. And so it was a little bit harder to kind of see until later when I get into Al-Anon and they start saying things like, you know, shake the family tree and just see what kind of alcoholics fall out. And but it took a long time for me to break through the denial of the fact that alcoholism really had played a major role in shaping the experiences of my life and a lot of the people that I had come to interact with and know. Thank you, Rick, for, you know, selecting me last minute even. I don't care. I think that, you know, anytime somebody asks me to participate in my own recovery, those are like special gifts. Doing sponsorship is really the same kind of thing. It's just you get to really work with somebody and watch them grow and change. And all they're doing is asking you to, you know, participate in your own recovery. That's what they do. It's a neat fellowship that we have. And I'll get into more of that maybe later, but why don't I just tell you a little bit about like my roots, my background. You can probably tell from the way I'm talking, Derry, that I might be just a little touch of Canadian, eh? There's a Toronto boy over there. And, but that's cool, eh? That's cool. And a lot of Canadians actually in our 7 o'clock Let's Rock group. And of course, you know, I'm the best one. Not really. I'm the sickest one. That's what I'll call myself. Somebody over here has got his two fingers up, and it means that I'm his second favorite because Alex Lifeson is his number one favorite Canadian. No resentment. Didn't make it on my four-step lift. Sorry about that, buddy. Anyway, so I grew up in a very large family. Basically grew up in a family of 14, feeling like the only child. And the reason for that was simple, you know. But before I get into that, when I was little, just before I could walk, like I'm basically learning how to walk, there wasn't a lot of money for toys, and so, there's the man up in the back with his finger up. I love you. My mother would keep these old, like, Venetian wine bottles that she had collected from the coast here, the wicker kind, you know, that she would put her candles in. And I would hold on to the wicker part of it, and I would sort of walk down the hall. And I'm stumbling around, and my oldest sister fondly looks at me and says, "Oh, look, it's a boozer." And from that point on, to my family, my nickname is Booze. That's what they call me. Do I belong in Al-Anon just for that? I think so. Anyway, the irony is at least not lost on me. So our family was very chaotic. I mean, for a couple of reasons. Its size, of course. And also the fact that, like, my dad, you know, who's a pretty brilliant kind of man, like, he's a designer of spaces, like national park kind of spaces and stuff. And he used to work here in California in the 60s and stuff, working up near Big Sur and being responsible for areas like that. Pretty cool guy. And then he ended up going to Canada to take a job to build basically Canada Parks and that part of their, like, federal government program. It was a big deal for him. And, you know, so I had about seven siblings that were born here in California. And they shipped, you know, in the 69, I think it was, they shipped out of here and went to Canada. And then 1970, I was born. And I remember, like, home felt strange. It was cool, though. Like, they had all these weird things from, like, Monterey Bay. But I'm in Canada, where there's 6 feet of snow outside. And I'm looking at these, like, fisherman nets and things like that. And I'm like, what are those? And my mother was like a big sort of artsy-fartsy type, you know. She loved to paint, and she loved to do all those things. And my dad and my mom, they loved each other incredibly. I know this. I didn't know that coming into Al-Anon. I thought they hated each other. Because they certainly fought like cats and dogs. And in my family, if you fought, that meant you cared for each other. It meant you had an opinion, and you're going to tell them what you think about it, and you're going to shape them up, and that's how you make the relationship good. Or so we thought. And so, I mean, they were kind of obsessed with each other, is the best way to put it. They'd spend all their time together if they could. And that meant, you know, us kids were just more or less fending for ourselves. And but every once in a while, they'd throw us into sort of a family group setting, sit us down and say, "Okay, we're going to do like a family council meeting." We didn't call it that. We called it the family B session. You can fill in the blank for what B means. And each kid was supposed to go around, basically, you know, voice a concern or an issue that they had. It's actually a lot like our group consciences. I didn't realize that until I got into Al-Anon. And then I realized why I hated group consciences. There's just a whole long, you know, seated resentment around those things. But I remember sitting there, and at the time, my duty at home, and every one of us had duties, you had to. My duty at the age of 5 was to wash all the dishes for everybody. And nobody does the dishes in the breakfast, nobody does the dishes for lunch. So when I'm home, it's at the end of school, the dishes are there from all day. And that means everything in the kitchen is dirty, everything. And it would take me sometimes 3 maybe 4 hours after school just to get that kitchen looking right. And I remember thinking, like, okay, I can maybe do this Monday through Friday, and then on Saturday I'll get a small break, like, because I don't have to go to school or anything. I can kind of just watch cartoons in the morning, but then the afternoon's back, and I'm back to, like, the chores. And then on Sunday, like, our families would have essentially a Thanksgiving dinner almost every Sunday. And you'd think that's great, unless you were washing the dishes. And so I remember, like, going, like, in that session, I remember, like, feeling so upset that I had to wash dishes on Sunday. I just wanted that one day off. In my five-year-old mentality, I mean, I don't know if you've seen a five-year-old lately, but they're not very big, right? And they're not intelligent, you know, they're just kind of, they'll blur about their feelings more than anything else. And I think I said something like, and tears just came out of my face, like, right, just like a Niagara Falls, you know, like. And as clear as yesterday, my mother took one look at me and said, "Next." And in that moment, my heart was crushed. And I made a decision right then, based on resentment, really, that I was never going to let something like that happen to me again. And I determined from that point forward that, okay, people don't really care about what I need or what I feel. So if I need something, I'm just going to have to get it for myself. It's all up to me. And I kind of live that way. That decision actually shaped just about every relationship I had from the time I was 5 on. And that was a powerful moment. You know, I could go in and talk about, you know, the time when my parents basically, you know, their relationship sort of busted up. Their marriage just went to, you know, went major south. In fact, my mother decided when she left to come back to California. Now, I didn't know this as a kid. Nobody had sat down and told us what was going on. I just knew that, like, Mom was complaining about how dirty the home was, and so there, the day came when she filled up, like, a truck, and we had this, like, silver liner trailer thing that she, you know, she would stay in her room by herself, and then later, being in the house was just too much, and she went out into that silver trailer, and then being in the silver trailer was too much, so she just packed everything in the house, all of our bedding, everything from the kitchen, all, like, everything, put it into that trailer, and then she drove away. And no one explained to me why we had nothing in the kitchen to eat on, no plates, no nothing. And my dad, clearly being absolutely devastated by that, because the greatest love of his life, the mother of 14 of his children, had just left him. And the way that the only way he knew how to get through that, having sort of grown up in an alcoholic home that was violent, was to become violent. And so, you know, for every day, you know, coming home was a matter of, like, okay, when am I going to get beat tonight? When are those hands going to be laid on me? What am I going to be hit with? I don't know. And my dad has never touched a drop of alcohol in his life. He's an untreated Al-Anon. And you know, I wish I could say that just happened for a little while, but it went on for about 3.5 years straight every day. And that did a number on, like, my sense of how I felt about myself. I ended up feeling just sort of like a major burden and a major problem. And so, you know, I did what I could to try and kind of get through those days. I became very bossy over my other brothers and sisters, a very Al-Anon trait for sure. And I figured, okay, well, there is no mother to kind of oversee all these things, so I'm going to just take over that role. And I'm going to be the guy that, like, you know, tries to kind of make this family look good somehow. And it was really difficult to do, though, because it was like, you know, I knew my mom and dad were having trouble before my mother left. But at least, you know, like, I could kind of pretend in public that that wasn't really happening. And when she was gone, it was sort of like, I felt like everyone could read me like a book. I didn't feel anonymous at all. I felt like people knew what kind of pain I was going through all the time, because I was just a hurting unit every day. And, well, what ended up happening, you know, is my dad ended up not realizing, you know, that not having better skills to live with at the time. You know, I ended up naturally just sort of feeling responsible for my mother leaving. Because I figured, you know, if I had just done a better job cleaning those dishes, And if I'd have done a better job, you know, being a better son, then maybe she wouldn't have left our family. And I went through like that period of time when the violence was at its highest point in my family. I kind of went through an incredibly juvenile delinquent period. I was breaking into people's homes and I was stealing friends' money. I was, I would, you know, go and shoplift from stores. I had a cap gun collection, I think, at one point. 150 strong, like how many cap guns does a kid really need, right? I was egging cars and buses on a pretty regular basis, got a pretty good shot at that, almost went into the baseball. No, that's not true. And I was basically roaming the streets late at night after my dad had gone to sleep, just looking for trouble. And the thing that's startling about that is at that time in my life, I had no idea who I am. None at all. And when I look back, I realize, wow, that's not me. That's not the man that I am. But at that time, I didn't know. I had no idea. I was just in so much pain. I was looking for any way to, like, alleviate that pain and feel like there was something I might have control over. So my dad ends up remarrying my mother's best friend, you know? And that was kind of weird. It was even weirder when she turned out to be lesbian and left my dad. And what makes it even weirder is I think she's probably one of the coolest frickin' people on the planet that I've ever met. It's funny how the world works, you know. And during those teen years, you know, as I was trying to make my way forward, you know, and I still had that old five-year-old mentality of it. Okay, well, I can't really reveal myself to anybody because they'll manipulate that. They'll use. I give them a foot of rope, and they're going to hang me with it. And so it made relationships really awkward, to say the least. And naturally, I was very interested in females. And the dating, though, was like I had no sense to how to do that. And so I just sort of figured, okay, well, dating rule number one, she has to be kind of cute. That helps. Dating rule number two, she has to know my name. Dating rule number three, she has to want to talk to me. And then it's done. Then it's like, oh, okay, so she's kind of cute. She knows my name, and now we're talking. It's on. Right? Hostage, let's go. Like, as much time as you possibly can. And some of the healthier girls that I dated dropped me in less than 2 weeks. And some of the crazier ones, it took 3 or 4 years. So, you know, it is what it is, you know. That's how those strategies work for me. And so, you know, I ended up sort of finishing high school, have no clue what to do with my life, none at all. Zero. Like, I can't even imagine actually where my life is heading past the age of 21. So I'm not thinking about college. I'm not thinking about, you know, any of that stuff. I'm just thinking, can I make it to 21? I'm super in survival mode. And so I get out there and I begin trying to live, and I get a couple of weird jobs. I get like job working at a gas station one place, and then I get a girlfriend who's dressed all GQ. She's like, "What are you working at the gas station for, dear boy? Why don't you work at a nice clothing store?" So I'm like, "Okay, cool." So I go work at Club Monaco for a little bit, and all of a sudden I'm dressed in like, you know, super threads and stuff, and I got no money, right? And that was kind of cool to sort of dress to look good. I got into that for a little while. And it's tiring. That's what I found. It's expensive. I also found that. And it's what is there? Who's the one that did the song? I think it was Janet Jackson. "What have you done for me lately?" All my girlfriends kept singing that song to me. You know? They'd be like, "What have you done for me lately?" You know, like, "Where's the gold and diamonds and jewelry and stuff?" I'd be like, "Oh. Okay, I think I need to do something different here." So I end up like one summer just sort of bumping into this girl that I had met a few years beforehand, but I kind of just completely forgot about. And I see her, and there's like this, and I know it sounds like I'm exaggerating. This isn't an exaggeration. This is what I saw. I saw her at this bus stop, and she was sitting, and she had a journal, and she was just writing it. And I thought to myself, deep. Oh, that's deep. Journaling, I can't do that. I can't give anybody, like, you know, information about my insides and write it down. Are you kidding me? That's deep, right? And I sit there and I'm just sort of watching her, and I waited about 15 minutes for her head to come out from writing so that she could, I'd see what her reaction was. And the longer I sat there and looked at her, the more a kind of a glow, like almost like light started to, a Madonna complex starts to happen. And I'm feeling this, like, I'm feeling the love, like, lift in me and stuff. And her eyes lift, and she has this smile. I'm done. And I know already she knows my name. I know that, like, she's cute. I knew that a long time ago. And now we're talking, so I guess it's on. It's on. There it is, man. Doesn't matter that she's got an engagement ring on her finger. Doesn't matter that, like, she doesn't live in the city. She lives, like, 5 hours away. I just figure, okay, I transplant myself 5 hours away. I find a way to go to the university to be next to her. I even lived for about 6 or 7 months on welfare to make that happen. Like, I was committed, you know what I'm saying? And I get into a foreign city where there's nobody else but her. And I'm just thinking, man, this girl's my answer. This is my ticket. And, you know, she was an actress and a singer, and my mother was a painter. I didn't make those connections until much later in my fifth step. But it was like, oh yeah, you know, dark hair, just like my mom. You know, gorgeous, stunningly, like, stunningly demanding. Do you know what I mean? Like, oh, the quality of this relationship just went to here because she gave me a do list. You know, like, that kind of crap. And I didn't realize later those just would become more and more hoops that I would have to jump through. But I loved her. I loved her with all my heart. I fell so hard in love with that woman that, like, I don't think I've ever fallen as hard and as much in love with anybody in all my life. And she's a wonderful, beautiful person to this day. You know, the thing that I think brought us together magnetically is the fact that, you know, I grew up an adult grandchild of an alcoholic, and she grew up an adult child of an alcoholic. And when we hung together, there was already kind of like the lingo, a vibe, a level of comfort that was already there. Like, hey, babe, I know you're broken. You know I'm broken. Let's take two halves and make a whole. That kind. You know, coming to Al-Anon, I learned that if you take a half a person and you put it with a half a person, they eat each other until there's nothing left. So, I had to learn that one the long way. But we ended up getting married. She asked me to marry her within 2 weeks of dating. That's when I knew she was the right one for me. No red flags there, none at all. I figured, okay, let's just smooth it on, let's keep going. And it was just like a roller coaster. I mean, I ended up like taking night school classes so I could get into university, and I found myself like on the upswing, like moving out of that whole like teenager, high school, I'm insane fucking phase of my life, and feeling like, oh, I'm an adult now, and I'm out there, and I'm, look at me, I'm married. I remember going to like one of the college, like, hey, come check out our courses. And the, you know, some of the students who were coming along, they were like looking at me and they said, wow, you're married. That's so cute. So, you know, I was married at the age of, I think, 23, but I looked like I was 16, right? Stunted growth doesn't just happen in some cases emotionally, it actually can happen physically too. In my case, it certainly did. And there I was, I had made my way somehow through grit and determination to get into one of the better universities that are there in Canada. And that did some to kind of like help me to feel like I might be going somewhere, I might be becoming, arriving. Maybe I'll get some recognition from this, maybe this will put me on a path that will give my life some meaning. And when I was done in university, I was really angry. Because I just spent a whole lot of money to realize that there's a whole lot more things I don't know about because of all the stuff I just learned. And so I figured, okay, well, that was dumb. If I learned anything from university, I guess I learned how to learn quickly. And that is a great skill, actually. While I was in school, you know, I was doing a little bit of music because, you know, I play a little guitar. My family, there's tons of musicians in my family. It goes all the way back to my grandmother and her great-grandmother and stuff. Piano players, bass players, drummers, guitar players, harp players, you name it. If you can play it, my family can probably master the thing in about 5 minutes. And it's like, music's just something we've always loved. And so I started doing that, and eventually that turned into a sort of a career. And a friend of mine that was at the university, who had come from the States, you know, he had sort of finished his schooling there and went back to Burbank, California. And he says, "Hey, Eric, what do you think about coming and living in California, man? What do you think? You won't have to, you know, you don't have to shovel sunshine, baby." And I was like, okay, all right, that sounds, I like the sound of that. You know, he asked me in December, by the way, and the snow starts to really come down in Canada. So, and I was like, okay, so I, you know, went through the heartache of working to get my wife a green card, and we ended up coming, and we did a music career here for a long time, and we started to see some success with that, and our career paths just basically split. As an artistic difference, that's all it was. But I couldn't see it like that. You know, I figured, you see, with her, it had gone from, okay, we're gonna like, you know, prop each other up and keep things going, so we can pretend to be like everybody else and nobody knows, the wiser, and least of all us, to like, you know, shredding each other like on a regular basis. I once heard a person say that, you know, at first their relationship, it was fun, and then it was fun with fights, and then it was just fights, and that's what it became. And so, like, even if our artistic, you know, veins were on the same path, we couldn't have stayed together. And it was the losing those opportunities and watching that career path, like, bite the dust that actually brought me into Alma. Because I just didn't know the woman I was married to anymore. And I didn't know myself either. I didn't know that. I just was super confused. And I had come into Al-Anon completely isolated. Very much like any of the problems I was having in my marriage, as they would happen and matriculate, like it seemed like each time a big thing would happen, friends of mine would just disappear. And it wasn't them leaving, it was me abandoning them to spend more time trying to fix that relationship. Until when I arrive in Al-Anon, my brother Matt goes, "Hey, why don't you sign up to Facebook?" And I go, "What's the point of that?" And he goes, "Well, you know, those old friends from back in the day, like, you can get to know them." And I says, "I don't like any of those people from the old days. Why do you think I was okay moving 4,000 miles to come here to LA, you know?" And he goes, "Well, just do it, you know, you'll enjoy it." And, you know, Al-Anon, the gift of Al-Anon is I came in a loner, majorly stressed out. I mean, the anxiety levels that I was hitting at, I was having, like, I think panic attacks probably 3-4 times a week, just total meltdowns. And, but I didn't have a problem. she was, I thought my problem coming into Al-Anon was a lack of information. So guess what I did when I got to the meeting? Oh, look at that literature table. I want everything, all of it now. I'm gonna go home, study it tonight. I'm gonna come back tomorrow, I'm gonna tell you the secrets in those books that tell you how to control and get what you want out of life. And I did that, and I didn't find any of those answers. And it would turn out later that, you know, as I was doing my step work, I'd start to realize what the real fundamental problem is for an Al-Anon. And it's not a lack of knowledge. I mean, if I think an alcoholic has a problem with a lack of knowledge, guess what my mouth is gonna do? It's gonna nonstop fill their head with information they don't want. And that'll turn into fights, which it did. And that's gonna turn into, like, you know, craziness. And so I just had to get down to, like, well, what is this alcoholism problem? So I can understand what it is we're trying to treat. And the best way I've heard it described was this. If an alcoholic's greatest obsession is to someday control and enjoy drinking like other people, then an Al-Anon's disease is to someday control and enjoy people. Like other people do. And in Al-Anon, I've come to learn that I can't have both. I can only have one. I can either try to control them, but I won't enjoy them. Or I cannot control them and enjoy them. And so control is really the major drug of choice for an Al-Anon like me. When I started looking at, like, the steps, you know, like, I remember coming into Al-Anon thinking, oh yeah, I'm gonna go to these meetings now. All right, once a month, hey, that should be enough. Lack of information, I can get them all in one night, no big deal. And I don't really like these people looking at me anyway, so I'm just gonna get in, get out, nobody gets hurt. That's the plan. And problem is, you know, I'm hemorrhaging at home, right? If I spend enough time alone at home, guess what I do? I do what I'm the best at. I hurt. I'm a master at that. I don't need any reasons. I can come up with my own. You know, that Netflix show wasn't very good. Like, I don't need reasons. I don't need alcoholics to get crazy. I got my own disease. So it's like, getting into all that, it was sort of like, okay, so, well, what is it? How does this alcoholism affect people? And I wrote down the ways it affects me. It's very simple. It's like, it makes me feel inadequate. You try to fix a disease that you're powerless to cure. You throw everything you got at it. Nothing works. And you walk away, if you're like me and your ego says, well, you should have been able to do that, but you failed. So I guess you're a loser. And when I come into Al-Anon, they go, no. That's not a defect, and that's not even a shortcoming. A shortcoming, to me, is some area of my life where I'm immature that I need to basically develop. So if I need patience and I don't have enough of it, I can work on developing and get more. Powerlessness over alcoholism is not something you can come into Al-Anon and work on and get power over it. And that took me probably into my 10th year of Al-Anon to realize that truth. Because I would work the steps and I'd go, okay, I should be getting better, right? I should now be able to, you know, say a few words, sprinkle some dust in the air and, like, you know, say a little prayer to whatever, and that person all of a sudden will think the way I want them to think, act the way that I want them to act, and feel the way I want them to feel. And when that didn't happen 10 years in, I almost lost it. Because I didn't really realize that step one, you know, where it talks about, you know, we're powerless over alcohol and our life had become unmanageable. I didn't have a problem admitting my life was unmanageable. for heaven's sakes, the back of my palm was almost stitched to the top of my forehead. Me telling everybody at every meeting I was at just how unmanageable it was. That part was easy to talk about. But to tell somebody I was powerless, it took me 6 or more years in Al-Anon to fully concede to my innermost self that to be powerless was not some kind of flaw. It's how God built us, so that it's a perfect insurance policy that will continually have a direct line and a need for it. And I love telling people, like, oh, okay, you took all the plans you have, you threw it at this alcoholic problem that you have in your life with your family or whoever, and nothing stuck, and you come in here feeling totally devastated, and I'm here to tell you, you are not a loser. You're just powerless like the rest of us. Even us people that have been around forever. We don't get any more powerful. We become, with more time and more recovery, we become more and more okay with it. And why? Because step two gives us a solution to that very problem that is very robust. And it took me a long time to like get past some very old ideas I had about God, higher powers, and all that business. And the way that my sponsor had me do step two was beautiful, and I love doing this with the people that I sponsor. I just have them write a list of the people that they've come to know in Al-Anon. And then next to their names, they'll simply write the reasons that they love them. And then I'll tell them, I says, and if you're having a hard time thinking of love, just write down what you like. That's good enough. And when I had compiled my list of the reasons I love the people, you know, from my home group here, this the 7 o'clock Let's Rock group, there's so many of the men there that I have come to know and love. These are some of the traits that I discovered my higher power has. It surprised me. So he's not boring. That's actually very important for me. He's not mean or fake at all. He's funny, he's very unique, he loves really great music. He plays guitar with a really mean sense of a wah-wah pedal. For real. You know what I'm saying? Hence the guitar thing. That's why, actually, I do the fingery sign. It's to let them know, like, that's the way I think about my higher power. The joy and the happiness of that kind of an expression is what I'm helping them see when they do that. Like, remember to have joy in your life. That's why you were created. Happy, joyous, and free. That's the goal. That's my goal now. And, helps me to feel that I totally belong, because I have a big problem with that. Very kind, very careful, very patient and gentle. Lights up every time he sees me. He likes to call me my boy. Just when I hear those words from guys in the group, especially from the elder statesmen that are in our group, and they look at me and they go, my boy, how are you? That love penetrates. And, I realized basically that if my higher power is greater than any human power, then my higher power is not less than any human power that restores me to sanity. So you guys are walking, living embodiments of my higher power. That's why it's so important for me to talk to you. Or I don't get to hear my higher power speak. It's amazing how much, like, there was this old idea I had about God, that God don't need nobody because he's God. He can do everything. And what I come to realize in my second step work is that, so what? God still needs you, Eric. He does? Why? He's got some kids. He's got some kids of his that he needs you to help. God ain't got no grandkids. Think about that. And he, you know, my higher power, I learned, trust me more than I do because he built me. He built in mechanisms that would come into play when I come into recovery. So he built me with a sense of the ability to be honest, even though I can be incredibly dishonest. And he knew that with the application of that through the step work, I would end up like coming to see my higher power for what my higher power really is. And my higher power is awesome. The more I think about my higher power, the more I think like step three is just a dummy. It's like, yes, okay, cool. All right, man, I know what'll happen if I go back to my old plans for trying to deal with alcoholism. Like if I wake up in any given day and I'm not feeling so hot, I know what things I've done in the past to try and get through a day like that. And it doesn't make the day better. I just go through and there's wreckage behind me everywhere. So instead I go, okay, God, I know what I'll do. I think you could do better, so I'm gonna let you. Let's see what you could do with your boy. I was visiting a friend in San Francisco, and he has like two stepdaughters. One was 8 and one was 13, and we're doing all this Halloween stuff, and it's a lot of fun. And as we're going around and interacting, like I'm paying attention to these little girls, and I'm asking them, well, what do you want to do, you know? How do you want this, your lawn to look, you know? Like, do you want these red rocks? Do you want these, like, ghosty white rocks? Like, what do you want? And so we picked out a bunch of stuff, and we get back home, and one of them loves to draw. And she hands me this picture as I'm like leaving. It just says, you're the best person I've ever met. And I did a bit of a double take, and I was like, because you see, something had shifted in me through the step work. Like, if you wanna get better, do the steps with a sponsor. I love that our 7 o'clock Let's Rock group has such a strong emphasis on that tradition. And so if you wanna get better, you do those steps with a sponsor who has done the steps, preferably, okay? Sit in a chair, do step work with a sponsor, and be a service. Those are the 4 tools that we have in Al-Anon to recover from the effects of alcoholism. They sound really stupid, don't they? 4 little S's should do the trick, really? All my plans won't work, but those 4 S's will. Try them, and tell me if it doesn't. I'm convinced that the reason that they work is because all 4 of those things orient me into my proper relationship with my higher power and people. And it's funny how, like, if you start following your kind of blueprint for how you're built, if you start actually obeying those guidelines, and you can figure out what they are, just do your 5th step thoroughly with somebody, and they'll walk you through it and say, okay, needs, here you go. And just start lining them up. How do you know that? Well, how'd you feel about these things? Well, yeah, I felt those things. What do those feelings tell you about what you need? You remember when you told yourself you're never going to feel again because it's too painful? Well, you're basically shutting yourself out from a major part of your life and a major source of information that can tell you a lot about what's right and wrong for you and what you need. The only way I could have ever gone through a 5th step is with somebody that I trust. And so, you know, I recommend going through that only with somebody that you can trust. Let me just finish by saying one last thing. I want to talk about my mother. I got to see her a few years ago, the last time I got to see her. And when I got home for a visit, the rest of my family was telling me how insane it was for me to go and try and visit my parents, my mother and my father, because they were living in a situation that was just hard to see. They were old and doing their best to take care of themselves, but not likely to ask for a whole lot of help. And so I get there and I call my sponsor and he says, okay, go in, try to keep it less than 2 hours, be a good son. That's why you're there. Doesn't matter what kind of parent they are. You're not there to exercise their parent. You're there to exercise your son. And so I went and we talked and my mother said to me, she goes, Eric, do you know why I had all those kids? And I thought, well, I'm just about ready to hear a bunch of baloney. Here it comes, you know. What's the answer this time, Mom? That's what I wanted to say, but I didn't, because I had you guys with me. I says, no, I don't know. I don't think you've ever told me. Why did you have all those kids? And she said, you know, in her old age, she goes, well, you know, I just didn't want to be alone when I'm old. And nobody comes to visit me anymore. But you've come. Thank you. And she says that Mother's Day card, inside of which I had written, I was still dealing with a lot of resentments at the time. I couldn't say, you know, Happy Mother's Day. I didn't feel that way. My sponsor said, just write, thinking of you. It's true. So she says that card, she has been looking at it for 3 months every day. And then she says the words that blew my mind. She goes, I just feel like I've been robbed of the ones I love. And I was like, did my mother just quote, like, understanding ourselves? Holy frickin' what? It was the first time, and about the only time, when I really felt like I could relate with my mother for the first time, that we had something in common. And she says, I want you to give me a kiss. And I'm like, oh, really? She had this big cornflake on her face, eh? And I was like, really? Gotta give you one, eh? And she goes, yep, you gotta give me a kiss. And I says, okay. So come on down. And I kiss the one cheek and I says, that's your I gotta give you a kiss. And then I kissed her other cheek. And I said, I want to give you a kiss. And she lit up like a Christmas tree. That's the kind of gift that Al-Anon can give, is it can transform relationships that seemed absolutely gone. And the power of this program is real. Transformations happen. You know, Al-Anon's not a program for people who want it. It's not even a program for people who, it's not a program for people who need it. It's not even a program for people who want it. It's a program for people who do it. And so I invite you, especially if you're new, if you're in your first 30 days, or if you're in your last 30 days, I want to welcome you to Al-Anon. And I want to tell you, do not leave before the miracle happens. God's like a bit of a magician. When the spotlight is truly on my higher power, he has a show to provide. And if you're willing to let go of some old ways and ideas, you might be dazzled by just how amazing your life can become. I know mine has. Thanks for letting me share. Yeah.